Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 877. Update on the Ukrainian crisis. This is being recorded on November 29th of the year 2015. As the title indicates, of course, we are going to be bringing up to date our coverage of the stunning and depressing events in Ukraine. However, this is something of a pivot point, ultimately, to a discussion of what is shaping up to be, well, sadly, what may very well turn into World War III, because the events that are taking place in Ukraine and the events that are taking place in the Middle East and in the Caucasus, and that in turn, by way of the refugee crisis, which is driving politics rightward in Europe in combination with the ISIS attacks in Paris and elsewhere. Also, politics in the U.S. are gravitating rightward as well. The events in Ukraine and events in Syria are dovetailing. And in turn, in a number of past programs, I have spoken about not only the pan-Turkish movement, but how it appeared to be dovetailing with elements of the Islamist movement and the Muslim Brotherhood. That appears to be that confluence of the Islamism and pan-Turkism appears to be manifesting itself in key places of the Earth Island. I think that's something very much, at this point, approximating World War III, and perhaps something that could turn into World War III if the reckless interests that are guiding things continue in their manner. That could very easily take place. We will be talking in our next two shows about things that not only have to do with Ukraine, but the pan-Turkish movement and the Islamist movement in Ukraine. Crimea, which has been facing a blockade of road traffic being implemented both by Crimean Tatars and by Pravi Sektor, has now been accompanied by the demolition of some pylons that have shut down electricity running to Crimea. And once again, Crimean Tatars, people of Muslim and Turkic extraction, and Pravi Sektor appear to be behind that. Earlier in For the Record 782, we spoke about President Erdogan of Turkey and his visit to Crimea to support the Crimean Tatars. That is part of his Islamist and pan-Turkist orientation. I would note this past week, of course, a Russian fighter jet that was conducting operations against various terrorist elements in Syria was shot down by a Turkish plane. The pilot and navigator ejected. The pilot was shot to death, and the corpse was basically taken by some militias, some Turkmen militias in Syria that are being supported not only by Turkey, but evidence suggests by elements of CIA as well. And the leader of the militia that appears to have killed the Russian pilot and that boasted of the retrieval of his corpse is a member of the Turkish Grey Wolves. That, of course, is the Grey Wolves is the youth wing of the National Action Party. That is a pan-Turkist, nationalist, and fascist political party that we have spoken about at considerable length in the past. We will be talking about Islamism, pan-Turkism, and activities that are resonating both in Ukraine and in Syria, and that could, I think, threaten to get out of hand and cause a third world war, kind of like what the way the situation in the Balkans ultimately accelerated to cause a Third World War. However, that is going to be coming up, the links between what is going on in Ukraine and private sector and what is taking place in the Middle East. That will be coming in program, but we'll be covering that in programs to come. However, there is a lot going on in Ukraine proper, none of it good, and these are things, too, that will have the most profound implications for the U.S. and for the future of humanity. It should come as no surprise whatsoever that a Council of Europe report on the, quote, investigation, unquote, that is theoretically being conducted by the Ukrainian government into the deaths of 42 pro-Russian protesters in Odessa in May of 2014. That probe has gone no place. No one has been indicted. Those pro-Russian protesters were chased into a building which was then set on fire. They were burned alive, and pro-OUNB and SS graffiti were scrawled on the building outside of the building in which they were incinerated. Some of their assailants outside chanted gleefully as they were burned alive. About the failure of the probe to produce any indictments, this is not surprising. An article in Bloomberg Business by Darina Daryna Krasnolutska, Krasnolutska, and Katerina Churizna, Churisina. I'm probably mispronouncing these names. The article is from November 4th of 2015, again, Bloomberg Business. Ukraine failing to probe pro-Russia protester deaths, panel says, unquote. Killings occurred in May of 2014 in Black Sea port of Odessa. No charges brought after 18-month investigation report finds. Ukrainian authorities are failing to adequately investigate 48 deaths, including those of 42 pro-Russian protesters in the Black Sea port of Odessa in May of 2014, according to an international panel set up by the Council of Europe. The demonstrators clashed with football fans and participants in a pro-government rally as the military conflict in Ukraine's easternmost regions erupted following Russia's annexation of nearby Crimea. Most of the deaths occurred after a building in which the protesters had barricaded themselves was set on fire. Despite the lapse of some 18 months after the events, not a single charge has been brought in respect of the deaths, the panel said Wednesday in an email report. The body is tracking the investigation to check that it meets the requirements of the European Convention on Human Rights and the European Court of Human Rights. And skipping down, the investigation in Odessa, like the probe in Kiev, has, quote, serious deficiencies in independence and effectiveness, the council's report said. The investigation into Kiev concerns the investigation into the sniper shootings of police officers, Ukrainian police officers, that ultimately led to the, well, not led to, but were the central element in the escalation of the Maidan hostilities that led to the installation of the OUNB heirs in Ukraine. It really comes as no surprise whatsoever that no indictments would be made, that no progress, no discernible progress has been made in either the investigation into the sniper shootings in the Maidan coup or the burning alive of the pro-Russian protesters, because organizations like Pravi Sektor are inextricably linked with the Ukrainian security services. Valentin Navalichenko, the head of the Ukrainian intelligence service, both under Yushchenko and from the Maidan coup in February of 14 on up through June of this year, was very closely associated with Pravi sector, and according to Dmytro Yaros, the head of Pravi sector, had worked very closely with Pravi sector on a number of, quote, anti-terrorist, unquote, actions in Ukraine. Now, that is something of a euphemism for basically assassinations and for, well, it means counterterrorism means, has come to mean in Ukraine, what it had come to mean in all too many other countries as well. Basically, counterterrorism has often served as a rubric for political terrorism, and that is most assuredly the case in Ukraine. So again, the fact that the probe, unquote, into the deaths of the pro-Russian protesters who were burned alive in Odessa, and the probe into who did the shooting in Kiev during the Maidan protests, they have gone no place, and that should come as no surprise whatsoever. We have covered the, frankly, farcical investigation into the sniper shootings. One of the people cited as a sniper shooting for the government into the protesters turned out, and they produced a photo, an alleged photograph of this guy holding a rifle. Turned out he only had one hand. He had lost a hand in a grenade training accident some years before. So this two-handed alleged shooter certainly could not have been the fellow they were fingering. And again, the security services in Ukraine are inextricably linked with the OUNB heirs that have come to power in that country. And the political leadership there is at one with those security services. We have done many, many programs about Ukraine. It is impossible in the context of this discussion to adequately sum up all of that information. One of the things that we have noted in the past is the extent to which political leadership in Ukraine has been imported from outside of Ukraine. The new finance minister in Ukraine is a woman named Natalie Jaresko, who is a Ukrainian-American who had previously worked for the Agency for International Development, basically a cutout for U.S. intelligence. One of her top aides is a woman named Janica Marilo, who is an Estonian of Ukrainian extraction, and the governor of the Ukrainian province of Odessa, in which the port city of Odessa is located. That was where the pro-Russian protesters were burned to death. The governor of Odessa is Mikhail Saakashvili, who previously was the president of Georgia, but who cannot return to his native country because he is facing serious criminal charges in Georgia. Now, President Saakashvili has been accused of attempting to foment a coup in Georgia, the country that he formerly led and to which he cannot return because of serious pending felony charges. A BBC article of the coup charges being leveled at Saakashvili was carried on October 30th of 2015. Georgia President Saakashvili accused of, quote, coup plot, unquote. And the story reads in part, Georgia has launched a criminal investigation into the former president, Mikhail Saakashvili, who was accused of a coup plot. In a leaked phone call between Mr. Saakashvili and the head of an opposition TV channel, he suggests using a, quote, revolutionary scenario, unquote, and makes plans to provoke violent confrontation, unquote. Skipping down. The channel's boss and Mr. Saakashvili have both confirmed the authenticity of the leaked phone call and accused the Georgian government of illegal wiretapping. That's kind of ironic in light of what they were talking about. In the recording, Mr. Saakashvili discussed erecting barricades to ensure a confrontation in which faces are smashed, unquote. That clash would take place outside the TV station to prevent its takeover. And again, it's more than a little ironic that Saakashvili is charging the government with illegal wiretapping. I don't know how legal or illegal that particular wiretap was, but in light of the fact that he is proposing to create a situation that would produce a violent confrontation, I think this is more than a little ironic.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
And again, Saakashvili cannot return to his native Georgia, the country of which he was once president, because he is facing serious felony charges there. And we have spoken about that in our previous discussions of Saakashvili. The situation in Georgia, or in Odessa rather, is a sorry one, and indeed that appears to be the case throughout much of Ukraine. Some local elections that were held in late October, I think are, not just me, but have given indications of widespread disillusionment on the part of the Ukrainian population. Not only was the voter turnout low, but the results were interesting. Former President Yanukovych's political party, or his supporters, actually gained in some of the local elections. So too did the supporters of Svoboda, that is the Ukrainian fascist organization, which, like Pravi Sektor, has evolved from the OUNB fascists who ruled Ukraine as something of an occupation government for the Nazis in World War II. Svoboda showed significant gains, not only in Lviv, but also in Kiev proper, Kiev being the capital of Ukraine. I would also note that a politician who specifically took his, basically used the name of a villain, the Emperor Palpatine from the Star Wars movies, also did very, very well in Ukraine. And I think a combination of the fact that the supporters of Yanukovych, who, although his removal from office was completely illegal and was a very obvious coup d'etat stemming from a covert operation, he was extremely corrupt and had alienated the population of Ukraine. He was just the latest in a long string of highly corrupt oligarch obligated, to coin the term, presidents of Ukraine, and basically they were corrupt and lent no pledge and did essentially very little with that country. And the country was an economic basket case. I would note that Yanukovych's finance minister was Petro Poroshenko, who is the current president of Ukraine. One of Petroshenko's advisors, as we have seen, is Roman Zvarych, who was the personal secretary to Yaroslav Stetsko, the World War II head of Ukraine, the head of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations for many years, and the head of the OUNB until his death in 1986, at which point leadership of the organization was taken over by his widow, Slava Stetsko, who then moved to Ukraine with Roman Zvarych after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and founded the Ukrainian National Congress. Roman Zvarych had previously served as the Minister of Justice, the equivalent of our Attorney General, both in the Yushchenko government and in both Tymoshenko governments. So again, apparently disillusionment, widespread political disillusionment in Ukraine is producing results that are not only disappointing from the standpoint that there is a very low voter turnout, but they have, in relatively pro-Russian regions, they have lent support to the political forces that had backed the ousted President Viktor Yanukovych, and also they are lending support to Svoboda and some of the fascist parties that had descended from the OUNB. They have also led to the successful political career of someone who names himself after Emperor Palpatine of, or I may be mispronouncing that, from the Star Wars movies. So it could be said, perhaps, in Ukraine that the force is with them. That's F-A-R-C-E. CE. From the Bloomberg View of October 26th of 2015, an article by Leonid Elio, N-I-D as in dog, Bershidsky, B-E-R-S-H-I-D-S-K-Y, Why a Star Wars Emperor Won Office in Ukraine. This reads in part, less than 2 years after Ukraine's revolution of dignity, unquote, local elections on Sunday handed power in the south and east to former supporters of the ousted President Viktor Yanukovych. The vote also created sizable ultra-nationalist factions in a number of local legislatures, including in the capital. The election proved voters' growing mistrust of the political class, which was only partially reshaped by the revolution, and revealed a disappointed nation that still is divided along an east-west line. Skipping down, in Odessa, where former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili was appointed as governor to turn the region into a showcase of Western-style reforms, Saakashvili's candidate was defeated by a wide margin. In the Ukrainian-speaking West, Svoboda radically improved its performance, coming in first in a few regions and second in critically important Lvov, Ukraine's cultural capital. The ultra-nationalist party also won a surprising 10% of the vote in Kiev itself. These results raised concerns that there could be a nationalist rebellion against Poroshenko if he is seen as being too soft on the separatists in the east. The Poroshenko bloc has had few successes to date. Skipping down. The 46.6% turnout may seem acceptable by the standards of European and U.S. local elections, but as commentator Leonid Shvets, S-H-V-E-T-S, pointed out, the indifference of half the voters in post-revolution Ukraine signifies, quote, a total mistrust of those who offer their political services, unquote. Perhaps the best symbol of that mistrust and the renewed separation between the state and the people is the election of Dmitry Palpatine to the Odessa City Council. If his last name seems familiar, and by the way, that's P-A-L as in Larry, P-A-P-I-N as in Nancy, beginning again, if his last name seems familiar, it is because he officially adopted the moniker of an evil emperor in Star Wars, also known as Darth Sidious. The newly elected city councilor's day job is as head of the Palpatine Finance Group. So, again, to a certain extent at least, and in a very grotesque fashion, life is imitating art in the Ukraine. And something that comes to mind, well, it is coming to mind increasingly in the world, but with regard to Ukraine, where, you know, certainly the country is in very bad shape, and with what basically, although you will never hear about this in our media, well, there's basically not only a fascist government, but one that has evolved from the World War II Ukrainian fascists of the OUNB, who were allied with Nazi Germany and who jumped to Western intelligence and became a key element of the Republican Party under the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization. In Ukraine, as Edith Wharton once noted, the very talented and famous American author, quote, a frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys. And again, with Ukraine disintegrating and with a member of the Odessa City Council having adopted the name of a Star Wars villain, and he gets elected and he's popular, things are getting really bad indeed. And note that in some areas, former President Yanukovych's supporters have done well. And in the West, Svoboda, one of the direct OUNB airs in Ukraine has improved its performances as well. And there remains the possibility, certainly there has been speculation, that groups like Svoboda and Pravi Sektor may ultimately engage in something of a civil war or an attempted successor coup to the Maidan coup, if in fact Poroshenko does not pursue his war against the separatists in the East. And in Europe, there is a lot of concern because basically Ukraine is rapidly metamorphosing into a failed state. However, we're not likely to hear that much about that here in the U.S., where all we're hearing about is big bad Russia and all the terrible things that they are supposedly doing. One of the reasons that I have been spending as much time as I have on what is going on in Ukraine not only has to do with the fact that that could very easily lead to a confrontation between two nuclear powers, namely the United States and Russia, but also the events there are quite stunning, in which not only have we seen the direct political heirs and successors to the World War II fascists, or World War II era fascists of the OUNB being installed in power, but we have seen in Ukraine proper the formal legal criminalization of the truth concerning World War II in Ukraine. It is now a criminal offense to say anything critical about the OUNB or its military wing, the UPA. And that includes pointing out their, as a matter of public record, collaboration with the Third Reich. Again, telling the truth about World War II history in Ukraine is now illegal. And although it isn't illegal outside of Ukraine, in fact, the way Western media, the American media in particular, have been behaving is altogether Orwellian in nature. And although it is not yet criminal in this country to criticize the OUNB, certainly the American mainstream media and even most of the so-called alternative media have adopted the party line and steered very clear of talking about the political forces in Ukraine as being the very obvious and explicit OUNB heirs that they are. One of the things that is extremely important about what is taking place in Ukraine, again, is the way in which the propaganda that is being developed under the rubric of journalism is now being implemented on a national and international scale. Again, in Ukraine proper, it is illegal to tell the truth about World War II history in Ukraine. Both former President Viktor Yushchenko, the beneficiary of the so-called Orange Revolution, and Petro Poroshenko went to the Babi Yar Ravine and laid wreaths in tribute to the OUNB. The Babi Yar Ravine was the scene of a very famous Holocaust massacre, really a series of mass shootings during World War II, and the bulk of the executioners, roughly two-thirds of them, were from the OUNB. So to lay a wreath in tribute to the OUNB at the Babi Yar Ravine, which both Poroshenko and his predecessor Yushchenko did, is the equivalent of going to Auschwitz and laying a wreath in tribute to the SS at Auschwitz. It is stunning, and perhaps the most stunning aspect of that is the relative lack of commentary and criticism in the West.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
And the implementation of what is being euphemized as information warfare, that is being institutionalized by the EU as it has been by the Ukraine, I'm not sure that it is ever going to have to be formally institutionalized in the U.S., although there are numerous NGOs advocating something very similar, because already our media are operating in an Orwellian lockstep. However, in the EU, there is now a formal implementation of what they are euphemizing as information warfare. Basically, this is beyond propaganda per se, but it is formal, state-authorized, and state-edited lying in order to counteract the effects of the truth. What is being represented in the U.S. and the West as, quote, Russian propaganda, unquote, or Kremlin propaganda, unquote, is quite simply the truth. To say that the OUN, that the forces that are in ascension in the Ukraine are the successors to the OUNB is not propaganda. It's not Kremlin propaganda or Russian propaganda. It is a fact. And in fact, groups like Pravi Sektor and Svoboda are altogether explicit and celebratory in their use of the OUNB as their political forebearers. They're quite explicit about that. On Stefan Bandera's birthday, they hold marches commemorating his birthday. That's on January 1st, New Year's Day. However, the criminalization of telling the truth about the OUNB and about World War II in Ukraine is being accompanied by a propaganda or information war effort in the EU. And there's something similar happening in the U.S., although it has not, as far as I can tell, been formalized to date. Coverage of this in Politico EU of August 27th of 2015, an article by James Panici, P-A-N-I-C-H-I, EU declares information war on Russia. The European Union's Foreign Affairs Department said Thursday it was launching a rapid response team to counter what it considers biased Russian media reports. The unit, which will include up to 10 Russian-speaking officials and media professionals from EU member states, will be fully operational by the end of September and will be part of the European External Action Service, or EEAS. Officials say it is a first step in the EEAS's response to growing concern in Eastern Europe and EU Baltic states about the destabilizing influence of Russian language news reports. Skipping down. The team, which will be based in the EEAS's Brussels headquarters, falls short of requests from Latvia that the EU establish a full-blown EU-funded Russian language television channel to provide an alternative source of news to Russian speakers in both EU and Eastern Partnership countries, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Moldova, Ukraine, and Belarus. One should remember that after the breakup of the Soviet Union, there were a great many Russian nationals or people of Russian ethnic extraction who were left behind, so to speak, in many of these countries, and they are not responding well to the resuscitation and propagandizing, the political resuscitation and political propagandizing about Third Reich and explicit fascist elements from World War II, be it the Baltic Waffen-SS units, who are now being celebrated as freedom fighters, or the OUNB heirs in Ukraine. More about this information warfare from GermanForeignPolicy.com, which feeds along the lower right-hand page of the SpitfireList.com website. From GermanForeignPolicy.com of November 4th of 2015, just going to read a single paragraph from their post called Media Cold War, which develops further the EU's information warfare directed against Eastern Europe, Russia, and in particular Russian-speaking minorities in various Eastern European countries. With a special team, unquote, the EU is seeking to create a pro-Western media audience in the East European countries and the Caucasus, including Russia, as was confirmed by the German government in its response to a parliamentary interpellation. The EU's East Stratcom team, unquote, seeks to establish networks of journalists in the countries of the EU's Eastern Partnerships, unquote, that includes Ukraine, and in Russia. It is also developing communication campaigns systematically aimed at the populations of these countries. Young people, unquote, and academics are among the specifically targeted audiences. Overall, the EU team is focusing on the urban middle classes, which in large sectors of Eastern Europe are pro-Western oriented and had significantly supported Ukraine's Maidan protests. Asked about the orientation of these activities, officially labeled as, quote, support for media freedom, unquote, the German government has explained that the purpose is to, quote, communicate, unquote, one's own position to the public, like the PR work of governments, parties, and associations. The government has also confirmed that the EU team will examine the East European activities of Deutsche Welle, or DW, Germany's international broadcaster, for possible synergy effects, unquote. And GermanForeignPolicy.com, again, which feeds along the lower right-hand page of the SpitfireList.com website, I have another insightful post into the nature of what seems to be developing vis-a-vis this EU information war. Of what appears to be a foundational influence on the information war that the EU is going to be conducting, we are going to turn again to GermanForeignPolicy.com. From November 13th of 2015, they have another post on the nature of this information warfare called Permanent Civil War. This is actually a reference to the Cold War when Germany itself was divided between East and West. And it turns out now that one of the ideological and methodological influences on this information warfare coming from the Bundeswehr, the German military, is going to be a specifically Nazi propaganda and ideological information warfare technique that was crafted by a general named Wolf, W-O-L-F, Stefan, S-T-E-F-A-N, Traugott, T-R-A-U-G-O-T-T, Graf, G-R-A-F, von Budisson, B-A-U-D-I-S-S-I-N. And I'm probably mispronouncing many of those names. But he was a general who served under Erwin Rommel in the Africa Corps in World War II. Beyond that, he had much to do with helping to shape the post-war German Bundeswehr, the German military. And one of the things that he did was to write a paper called the Himmelroder Memorandum, which basically expressed the viewpoint of former Nazi Wehrmacht generals and had much to do with the rehabilitation of Third Reich veterans for inclusion into the post-World War II German military. And again, this guy, Graf von Budisson, is being hailed by an article in a publication put out by the Bundeswehr, the German military, as someone whose techniques can prove very useful in countering, quote, Russian propaganda, unquote. So again, from Permanent Civil War from GermanForeignPolicy.com from November 13th of 2015. Techniques of anti-Soviet propaganda that had been developed by Nazi officers could serve today as a model for Western anti-Russia psychological warfare operations, according to a semi-official publication from the entourage of the Bundeswehr. The current conflict between Russia and NATO has a, quote, highly pronounced ideological dimension, unquote, analogous to the Cold War, explains the author, Uwe Hartmann, H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N, a colonel in the German armed forces. According to Hartmann, the Russian side is using, quote, the freedoms of Western open societies, unquote, to, quote, influence, unquote, public opinion with the aim of, quote, relativizing the value of rights and freedoms, unquote, sowing discord, unquote, and insecurity within the population, unquote. To counter this strategy attributed to Russia, Hartmann recommends reversion to the methods of the so-called internal leadership, unquote, concept elaborated by Wolf, Graf von Baudissin, who had been on Hitler's general staff. This concept calls for preparing the armed forces as well as the society at large for a permanent civil war, unquote, and for the leadership elite to convince Germans of the, quote, worthiness of defending their country while immunizing them against all ideological temptations and propaganda attacks, unquote. I suspect that the permanent civil war, interjecting here, also is looking forward to the conflicts between people willing, and there aren't a lot of them, at least in the U.S., willing to embrace the truth about places like Ukraine and the society as a whole. Ultimately, I expect that if they're not formally rounded up and put into prison, which might be difficult to do from a legal standpoint, I think at some point journalists and authors and commentators in the U.S. May very well be deep-sixed, as they apparently have been in Ukraine already. There have been a number of very suspicious deaths of anti-government and pro-Russian activists and demonstrators, journalists in particular, in Ukraine. Skipping down in the permanent civil war post. To counter the alleged Russian ideological aggression against the West, Colonel Hartmann recommends resorting to the theoretical works of the German military officer Graf von Baudissin, who in World War II had served on the general staff of the Nazi Wehrmacht's Africa Corps under General Erwin Rommel, the famed Desert Fox. In 1951, von Baudissin joined the staff of the Administration Blank, unquote, the predecessor to West Germany's Ministry of Defense, charged with the illegal reestablishment of the armed forces. He helped formulate the so-called Himmerover Memorandum, that's H-I-M-M-E-R-O-D-E-R, in which former Nazi Wehrmacht generals laid down the conditions for their participation in the remilitarization of West Germany. The demands raised by the memorandum included, quote, the liberation of Germans convicted of war crimes, the termination of any form of defamation of German soldiers, including the Waffen-SS, deployed at the time in the framework of the Wehrmacht, unquote, and the introduction of the necessary, quote, measures to transform both domestic and foreign public opinion, unquote, by the way. The 14th Waffen-SS Division was the Galician Division composed of OUNB Ukrainian veterans. So this would also apply directly to any criticism of the 14th Waffen-SS. Continuing. Baudissin developed the Bundeswehr's concept of internal leadership, unquote, aimed at preparing Bundeswehr troops for a permanent civil war, unquote, against the Soviet Union, a concept Hartmann now seeks to literally apply to the current political situation. Skipping down. Based on his assessment, Hartmann draws conclusions for how, quote, strategic communication, unquote, aimed at German society and the Bundeswehr should be designed. On the one hand, quote, resistance to propaganda-induced insecurity and ideological temptations, unquote, must be strengthened, and on the other, readiness, quote, to provide moral support to those using military or other forms of defense against these hybrid threats, unquote, must be enhanced, the officer declares. According to Hartmann, all measures capable of, quote, exposing the enemy propaganda narratives, unquote, are of fundamental importance. This is particularly true in cases where the enemy takes up, quote, historically sensitive subjects, unquote, and, for example, criticizes actions of German soldiers on operation in regions, quote, where the Wehrmacht had once carried out operations and SS forces had ravaged. Again, this is very interesting because this is one of the central pylons, so to speak, buttressing the information war that is going to be taking place. And again, this comes from a semi-official Bundeswehr publication, that is the German military. exposing the enemy propaganda narratives, quote, are particularly true in cases where the enemy takes up historically sensitive subjects. That's certainly true in Ukraine. And, for example, criticizes the actions of German soldiers on operation in regions, quote, where the Wehrmacht had once carried out operations and SS forces had ravaged. That certainly applies to Ukraine, and as we have seen in the past, there are German military advisors that are helping to back the quote-unquote counter-terrorist operations in the East.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Another aspect of the information warfare that we are being subjected to concerns the continued reticence on the part of the American intelligence community to release their electronic reconnaissance information vis-a-vis the shootdown of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over Ukraine. That was allegedly done by pro-Russian separatists using a BUK missile system that they had obtained. However, as we have looked at in some of the coverage from Consortium News, U.S. photo reconnaissance experts believe that actually Ukrainian soldiers, perhaps acting on their own, very possibly drunk, fired the battery that brought down that plane. It was not Russian separatists. However, that has never been officially... That information has never been officially disclosed. In another article in Consortium News, one of the very few websites that has not been marching in lockstep with regard to what has been taking place in Ukraine, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern has an article or a post from August 17th of 2015 called Propaganda, Intelligence, and MH17. It reads in part, "During a recent interview, I was asked to express my conclusions about the July 17, 2014 shootdown of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over Ukraine, prompting me to take another hard look at official Washington's dubious claims, pointing the finger of blame at Eastern Ukrainian rebels and Moscow based on shaky evidence regarding who was responsible for this terrible tragedy. Unlike serious professional investigative reporters, intelligence analysts often are required by policymakers to reach rapid judgments without the twin luxuries of enough time and conclusive evidence. Having spent almost 30 years in the business of intelligence analysis, I have faced that uncomfortable challenge more times than I wish to remember. So I know what it feels like to confront issues of considerable consequence, like the shootdown of MH17 and the killing of 298 passengers and crew amid intense pressure to choreograph the judgments to the propagandistic music favored by senior officials who want the U.S., quote, enemy, unquote, in this case, nuclear-armed Russia, and its Western demonized President Vladimir Putin to somehow be responsible. In such nations, the easiest and safest career-wise move is to twirl your analysis to the preferred tune or at least sit this jig out. But the trust us, it was Putin marathon dance has now run for 13 months, and it's getting tiresome to hear the PR people in the Office of Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, claiming that the U.S. intelligence community has not revised or updated its analysis of the incident since July 22, 2014, just 5 days after the crash. Back then in Clapper's office, trying to back up Secretary of State John Kerry's anti-Russian rush to judgment, cited very sketchy evidence in both senses of the word, drawn heavily from, quote, social media, unquote, accounts. Obviously, the high-priced and high-caliber U.S. intelligence community has learned much more about this very sensitive case since that time, but the administration won't tell the American people and the world. The BNI's office still refers inquiring reporters back to the outdated report from more than a year ago. None of this behavior would make much sense if the latter U.S. intelligence data supported the hasty finger-pointing toward Putin and the rebels. If more solid and persuasive intelligence corroborated those initial assumptions, you'd think U.S. government officials would be falling over themselves to leak the evidence and declare, quote, "we told you so," unquote. And the DNI office's claims that it doesn't want to prejudice the MH17 investigation doesn't hold water either, since their initial rush to judgment did exactly that. So, despite the discomfort attached to making judgments with little reliable evidence, and at the risk of sounding like former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, it seems high time to address what we know, what we don't know, and why it may be that we don't know what we don't know. And this next paragraph is critical. Those caveats notwithstanding, I would say it is a safe bet that the hard technical intelligence evidence upon which professional intelligence analysts prefer to rely does not support Secretary of State Kerry's unseemly rush to judgment in blaming the Russian side just 3 days after the shootdown. Again, I think that is common sense. If, in fact, the data that had come to light supports that evidence, believe me, we would be hearing about it 24/7. The fact that it has not been made public, I think, argues very strongly for the alternative analysis, namely that the blame was not on the Russian separatists and or Putin. And again, there was an article that we have used from Robert Perry's consortium news site that has discussed information from photo intelligence specialists that had conferred privately with Robert Perry, that the photographs show Ukrainian government soldiers apparently drunk from all of the empty beer bottles around them who had fired the fatal missile. Something that we have spoken about in the past is the fact that one of the very first people on the scene and the head of the OSCE's special mission in Ukraine is a guy named Michael Bashurku, who not only has very strong links to the OUNB milieu, but who also has networked with Malaysian Muslim Brotherhood elements linked to the founding of the International Institute for Islamic Thought, and that is one of the front organizations that was apparently used to channel monies to various jihadist groups, including the Afghan Mujahideen and others. The IIIT was one of the organizations that was popped in the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002. And another of the founders of the IIIT was former Malaysian president and Muslim brother Anwar Ibrahim, a consulting client of Grover Norquist, and one of his political acolytes was the pilot of MH Flight 390 that went down in March of 2014. Not sure if it was MH370. Anyway, the Malaysian airliner that disappeared. And they said, well, was it space aliens? Was it a black hole? Hell, it was piloted by an acolyte of a consulting client of Grover Norquist, who was involved with the same milieu that was busted in the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids. The last two stories I'm only going to have a chance to touch on very briefly, and I think these are useful for giving us something of a peep between or through the boards of the propaganda structure that is being erected around us. An article that appeared on page 3 of the Financial Times of February 15th of 2015 was a story by Courtney Weaver called "Renewed Sense of Identity Takes Hold in Donetsk," and it's talking about the fact that in the Donetsk People's Republic, the separatist regions of eastern Ukraine, talks about the sentiment of the people there, and it's very interesting because many of them, thoroughly disillusioned with the altogether corrupt Viktor Yanukovych government, initially were supportive of the Maidan coup, but then when the virulently and inflammatorily anti-Russian OUNB elements came to power in Ukraine and began making overtly threatening statements about Russians in Ukraine and about Russia itself. There have actually been threats by Svoboda and Pravi Sektor to wage war on Russia. Many of them became disillusioned with Maidan, and then when the war came, they were thoroughly disillusioned as well. Some of the coverage here. After a month-long siege that has destroyed local infrastructure, left the population under the near-constant percussion of artillery, a new sense of regional identity has taken hold in Donetsk. Although some of it is being transmitted via top-down initiatives such as Miss Prasova's class, much of it has come through the Ukrainian army's shelling, which has turned many former pro-Ukrainian locals against Kiev. Another source of anger for many was an October speech by Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, in which he declared that the region's citizens would suffer for the rebel leaders' actions. Quote, "Our children will go to school and nursery school, and theirs will sit in the basement," he declared, waving a finger. "As a student, as the future generation, I was for a united Ukraine. We really believed in Poroshenko," said Ekaterina, a 20-year-old at Donetsk National University. While her family fled to the Ukrainian side during the summer, they were forced to return to Donetsk in September after they ran out of money. Then her feelings changed. Skipping down. "You don't need to be a soldier to understand from what direction artillery fire is coming," unquote. And again, not only the anti-Russian statements by the OUNB heirs in western Ukraine, but the shelling itself has fundamentally alienated many of the people in eastern Ukraine who had previously been sympathetic to a change of government because of the corruption of Yanukovych. There also is a very interesting post, which is in its entirety in the description for the record 877, which will be available presently. It is by Natalie Baldwin from Consortium News of November 19th of 2015. It's called "How the Russians See the West and Russia," and it has a very interesting perspective on many things, including the, quote, annexation, unquote, of Crimea, and pointing out that Crimea had long identified with Russia, and skipping down. "Moreover, Crimeans that I interviewed who participated in or were witnesses to events that led up to what is variously referred to as the Crimean Spring or the Third Defense of Sevastopol," unquote, did not expect the Russian government to step in and assist them or to accept their request for reunification. This was due to the numerous times since the 1990s when Crimeans voted either directly or through their parliament for a reunification with Russia, which Russia had previously ignored. And this is something, I'm including this here and reading this, because this is something that we simply never hear about in this country, that there were any number of votes, either directly or through the Crimean parliament, to reunify with Russia, and those had previously been ignored. It is interesting to speculate to what extent the Maidan coup itself, obviously the result of a covert operation, as we have seen, actually led to the successful secession of Crimea, which really comes closer to the reality of events. Again, that entire article is in the description for the record 877, but we don't have time to read that because this concludes for the record 877. Update on the Ukrainian crisis being recorded on November 29th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.